So I'm really passionate about this relationship, but it's the relationship between trust and humility. One of the things that trust enables, when we have trust in ourselves and when there is trust in our cultures, there is psychological safety, it enables us to be confident in what we don't know. And that is actually my definition of humility. Humility is a confident relationship with what we don't know.
Culture first.
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 I'm your host, Damon Klotz, and you are listening to Culture First, a podcast where you'll hear stories about why being intentional about your company culture can create a better world of work.
The importance of trust in the workplace is top of mind this year, especially as trust is one of the foundations of a great remote working experience. But trust needs to work both ways. The question isn't, can employers trust their employees? It's, can employees trust their employers? Rachel is a trust expert. She's an author and a lecturer at Oxford University, passionate about challenging ideas around trust and humility. She's been recognized as one of the world's 30 most influential management thinkers and honored as a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. Rachel's TED Talks have garnered more than 5 million views, and just like my conversation with her, they are full of laughter and warmth. Rachel defines trust as a confident relationship with the unknown. And in this short part of our chat, she really helps us understand how we can cultivate that in our workplace.
If I've got this understanding of trust, you know, being a confident relationship with the unknown requires me to have humility, which is a confident relationship with what I don't know. But for me to have that humility, I feel like that's when ego steps in, and ego's going to be like, I guess, maybe the thing that maybe stops me from letting those two things coexist together.
Exactly. So ego is what I describe as a pull. In order to have humility, you have to be able to be comfortable in the unknown. You have to be able to make room for doubt. And we are not good at that. And the reason why we're not good at that is because of these pulls. And one of the most powerful pulls that pulls us back to the known, people, ideas, beliefs that feel safe and familiar to us, is ego. Because ego is really worrying about what other people think of you. And ego brings out the need to compete and the need to prove ourselves and the need to be right and the need to win and the need to dominate. And all those things are not great for humility. They're not great for sitting in this space of the unknown and discovering and exploring what you might find there. Ego is completely, it's I call it a pull. Some people call it a gremlin or a blocker. But the reason why I like it, it's a pull, is because you really have to become aware of how powerful this force is that takes you away from that place of being not just comfortable, but excited by not knowing. I often say that if you understand and can visualize this relationship between trust, humility, and ego, so trust enables you to practice and be in a space of humility, and ego is the thing that gets in the way. You will observe team meetings, conversations, the way individuals behave, the way leaders behave. You suddenly see it through a whole new lens. Even if someone's very self-aware, these things come up all the time. When employees may have seen sort of untrustworthy behavior, they may have raised it internally, right? And then maybe there was some leadership communications addressing that. But that's just not enough. It's actually using that voice and that activism to hold their organizations to account. And that may make many leaders extremely uncomfortable. But I think that's only going to get more and more amplified. And then also not feeling like, you know, the conversation has to stay inside, but realizing. And so it's a very interesting dynamic when an employee makes public the wrongdoing inside of a company. When you actually stop to think about that, that is a huge shift in trust and power dynamics that we really haven't seen before.
Even just like when you hear the term like, you know, employee whistleblower, it used to be something that was more union focused, or it was to do with a, you know, maybe a certain type of industry where someone was trying to, you know, expose unsafe practices or something to do with that. But I think what, you know, with the rise of employee activism, it's not just about you're trying to voice something to a union to get, you know, like better rights or a safer working condition. It's really about the human experience we're having inside of the workplace and voicing some of those things. And I think we're seeing a huge rise in companies who are feeling like their trust has been breached, willing to voice that. And I think, you know, with that obviously comes maybe to kind of segue into this, is to actually get to that level of like wanting to voice your opinion and like actually having a deeper conversation about trust. You know, the word that comes up a lot is vulnerability and whether we're willing to be vulnerable. And I touch on this because I want to get into the specifics about it and actually showcase how that looks. But before we do, one of the things that I've mentioned to you and your team in the past is around Coltramp's values, because it touches on both of these words. You know, we have one of our values, and it's our first value, which is have the courage to be vulnerable. And, you know, it's first for a reason. And then our third value is trust others to own decisions. You know, based on some of the work that you've done and the writing that you've done, you've said that vulnerability precedes trust. So it sounds like we've got our values in the right order, but like, why is getting it in the right order so important?
Yeah, I should say it doesn't always precede trust. It can follow, particularly if people don't feel safe or they're in what we call sort of a low trust state. You can't have zero trust or even what we call low trust, which is like complete apathy or no information. To ask people to be vulnerable in those situations is an extreme stretch. So you've got some baseline level of trust. And then I think Dan Kaur's work on this is brilliant. So he describes this idea that is really visual called a vulnerability loop. And so the way it works and the way it's rocket fuel for trust is, say, Damon, you send me a vulnerability signal. So you actually did this at the start of the podcast, right? Telling me something personal. If I don't catch it and sort of respect the signal and then in some way signal back, that leaves you really exposed and that will damage trust. But if I send a signal back, we go in this loop and it really accelerates trust, particularly early on in relationships. So I always think it's interesting, like people you work with, for some people, it can take a few weeks or even a few months when you see that first vulnerability loop. And as a leader of a team, sometimes you could keep putting vulnerability signals out there and the other team person doesn't pick that up. But the first time you see that loop really in action and you see other people starting to pick up on that loop, it's really powerful. As I said, in other situations, you need a lot of trust for vulnerability to happen. And that can be where people have had a very bad experience in the past from their childhood. There's something that has happened in their family, but also in the workplace where someone has breached their trust in a big way. Now, asking that person to be vulnerable before trust is there, it's more than a stretch. It's actually not respecting where that person is and what that person needs. So the idea that for people to trust a leader, they must demonstrate full confidence in their capabilities and in their knowledge and in their skills. And the admission that they don't know something or they don't have the answer yet is perceived as a weakness. And you see this everywhere, right? So you see the pressure on economists to give forecasts when financial markets are uncertain. You see the pressure on politicians to give clear and firm answers about when the pandemic will end when it's impossible to know that yet. I even see it in, to be honest, my own children who are 7 and 9, who are being encouraged to have very strong opinions on things like privacy rights and transgender that are really too complex still to understand. And the ability in society and culture that is so wired to value confidence and conviction and certainty means that humility is taken a beating. And it's very easy to say, but how we create cultures where people say, not even I don't know, but I'm not sure would be a good first step. I don't know. Or, you know what, I got that completely wrong. And what do I learn from that? You know, you think of what that will change in terms of the curiosity, the openness, the courage, vulnerability, everything that can inject into organizations. And so I think it's one of the most important shifts that we need to make happen. And just to share actually something I have learned over the last few weeks that has made me rethink capability. And I thought this was really interesting. I haven't actually shared this with anyone yet, but you know, I always thought of capability as a hard trait, skills, knowledge, things that we sort of build up. But if you go to the root meaning of the word capability, it comes from capex, which in Latin means space or to hold much. Capability isn't actually about the skills that we fill our resumes with. It's the ability to be able to hold a space, right, to be able to sit in that unknown. And I had never thought of capability in that way. So yeah, this is, I think, a really interesting area that is emerging in terms of how does it become okay for anyone in an organization to say they're not sure, they don't know, or they don't know yet, and for that to be perceived as a strength, not a weakness.
I speak so often about holding space and about like that, you know, I'm trying to create containers for conversations. And so like a little insight on capability is something that I will definitely spend some more time thinking about. But I think when you were sharing some of that, I know for me personally, like when I struggle to say, I don't know, I was wrong, I'm not sure, for me, it's like my career has operated in like lots of like strange spaces where I was either like the first to do a certain role, or like there was an emerging technology that I like tried to like teach people about, or even in my role as a work culture evangelist. Like it's a very made up title, and I do very like a very broad range of work, and it's not easy to kind of like hire for someone like me, or I don't fit into a box. So when I don't fit into a box where like my capabilities, I guess, are, you know, uniformly recognized, for me to say, like, I guess like sometimes my ego plays in, like people don't know like enough about like how I work or what makes my role, you know, tick. That for me to say that I don't know what I'm doing is just like massive imposter syndrome coming back of like, you already like play on the edge in this field talking about workplace culture and marketing and stuff. So I think that's what's always stopped me, is like my imposter syndrome just like flies out the door when I have to say some of those things.
But, you know, I think there's actually a distinction between I don't know what I'm doing, which is tied to action, right? Like when you say that to me, like you're already in action, you're taking action around something, whereas I don't know the answer to something is actually about not doing something, right? It's actually saying, you know, if I take action on this, I'm not sure it's the right kind of action. So I think there's a difference there. I know it sounds subtle, but I think there is a difference between I don't know what I'm doing, which means you're already in it, versus do you know what, I just need a bit more time and space to actually reflect so I can come back to you with a better answer or with a better solution. So I think what some people they think, oh, this is, you know, makes them feel really uncomfortable, is I'm not saying you stay in this state of indecision and reflection and doubt forever. It's about holding that space for long enough so that when you do make a decision or where you do give an answer, you actually have more conviction and belief in your decision making.
If this conversation has left you wanting more, the link to the full episode is in the show notes. I'm Damon Klotz, and the Culture First podcast is brought to you by the team here at CultureAmp, the world's leading employee experience platform. Learn more about CultureAmp by heading to cultureamp.com. We believe in creating a better world of work. And if that's important to you, please subscribe and leave us a review to make sure that you don't miss a single episode.